We want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives. But can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now, welcome your host, Jen Lumenlon.
Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Your Parenting Mojo, which is called What Do Children Understand About Fairness? And I have two very special guests with me to discuss this topic. Dr. Peter Blake earned his doctorate in education at Harvard University and is currently an assistant professor at Boston University's Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences. His research focuses on three important foundations of human life: cooperation, fairness, and ownership. And so he asks questions in his research like, when should you share and when should you compete for resources? Is equal always fair, or can you sometimes keep more for yourself? And how do you know when a toy is owned, and what does that mean? Right now, he's working on extending projects to different cultures so we can better understand whether children in all cultures develop in similar ways at similar times and what cultural variables influence that development. Welcome, Dr. Blake.
Thank you.
And Dr. Katie McAuliffe is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at Boston College, which I just learned is different from Boston University. She too studies the development and evolution of cooperation in humans, with a special focus on how children acquire and enforce fairness norms. She's made the rounds of Harvard, Yale, and Cambridge in her educational career. I think the only one she's missing is Oxford. Welcome, Dr. McAuliffe.
Hi, nice to be here. Thanks.
Thank you so much for being here. So let's start with a question that seems really simple, but I'm guessing there's probably more to it than maybe I might imagine. Can you tell us what fairness is?
Yeah, that's the big question.
Oh, great.
And it is a very there's a complicated answer. So fairness is a very complex concept, particularly for adults. And we know that equal is not always fair. But equality does provide a kind of starting point for us to understand how children figure out what is fair and what is not. So we tend to focus our research in a couple of ways. One way is that we focus on the allocation of resources, which has also been called distributive justice, how you distribute resources between people. So we focus on that aspect of fairness as opposed to social status and things like that. And we also focused around this idea of equality, and particularly what happens, how do children respond when they get less and get more than other kids?
Hmm. And I think studying sort of how fairness develops in childhood is a nice way of showing how flexible the concept is, because when we look at how children begin to think about fairness, you can see that what it means to be fair really varies depending on whether you're a 2-year-old or an 8-year-old.
Mm. How does that change?
Well, we can kind of get into that with lots of different studies, but maybe a sort of broad way to characterize the change, and this is based on work that was really done in the 70s, is that fairness tends to start out as being quite self-focused. So I want to make sure that I'm getting a good deal. And it goes through a period of sort of really caring about equality, as Peter said, as like a sort of benchmark of justice. And then it becomes much more nuanced, where you can take different perspectives into account and understand that sometimes someone is more deserving or more needy, and therefore inequality is acceptable under certain situations.
Mm. Most of the parents listening to the show are sort of parents of toddlers and some parents are preschoolers. And I know that you start to study children kind of around about age 4 or 5. Why don't you study children younger than that? What is it that makes that difficult?
Well, it's primarily there's very different methods that are used for infants and toddlers, largely because they don't have the verbal skills yet to do some of the tasks. We have tried to test children as young as 3 in some of our experiments. That works fine. But younger than that, we've found that they don't do well on our tasks. But other people have done research on infants. And one key thing that they found, going back to this idea of equality, is that even at about 15 months of age, infants expect resources to be distributed equally between two people. And they expect adults to divide things like food and toys equally. They're surprised when this doesn't happen. And this has been shown in several different infant studies now. So that's goes back to this idea of equality as a kind of foundation. Now, where that comes from, this could have been learned through experience. 15 months of age is still quite a long time of life. But they're learning just by observing. This isn't based on their own behavior, so they're not kind of constructing this idea of equality from their own experience.
Hmm. So are you saying that if I always make sure that I get a bigger piece of chocolate cake than my husband does, that my daughter might not understand fairness to mean equal?
I wouldn't go that far. But by the time we get up to about 3 years of age, you can ask kids, you can ask them explicitly what they think is fair. And one of the things that we've found in some of our studies is that when we give children a set of stickers, for example, and we ask them, how should you divide this up with another child? They'll say, yeah, I should give half. But then when we give them a chance to actually give to the other child, they'll keep more for themselves.
Mm.
So they recognize that there's this norm of an equal split in that context, but they don't follow it. They tend to favor themselves. And this is this idea of a bias to favor oneself is something we see in other variations of studies, including the big ones that Katie and I have worked on together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I think Peter's pointing to a really important distinction in the types of studies that are done looking at fairness, sort of this children's expectations of what ought to be done versus what they actually do. And so most of our work really focuses on children's behavior. So we put them into these games inspired by behavioral economics where they're making decisions that affect both their own payouts as well as a partner's payout. And I think this is part of the reason why we tend to start around four, that those contingencies and the payoffs and the sort of structures of the games are just hard to understand for children younger than that age.
And when we say economics to kids, we use candy and stickers as our currency.
Right.
Both things that are very attractive to kids. So So I've seen a bunch of, I've read a lot of your papers and I've seen a bunch of diagrams of how you do these experiments. Can you just maybe talk us through one of these experiments and how you actually test this kind of thing?
Yeah. So the one that Peter and I started back when we were grad students at Harvard, it's called the inequity game. And this is a game that we developed that we've subsequently used across a lot of different papers. And the way this works is we go out to different public areas and we recruit two children, typically children that do not know one another, to play a face-to-face game. And in this game, one child makes all the decisions. So they have control of this apparatus, and they are making decisions that affect both how many Skittles they get as well as how many Skittles their partner gets. And so they're called the actor. They're the one who's making the decisions that we care about. Then the other participant is assigned the role of recipient. They're sort of passive in this game. They just get whatever they get based on the actor's decisions. And then from there, the structure is really very simple. So an experimenter will put different amounts of candies on two trays, one for the actor, one for the recipient. And essentially, the actor just decides, do I want to accept that allocation or do I want to reject it? Now, if they accept it, they'll get some candy and the recipient will get some candy. But if they reject it, and this is the interesting part, the candy gets put into a middle bowl and nobody gets to take those candies home. So it's an all or nothing game.
Hmm.
And we use this game to kind of understand what distributions children will accept and which ones they'll reject. And the sort of the simplest distinction is one where they're either getting an equal payoff. So the actor's getting one candy and their partner's getting one candy. And as you might imagine, children tend to be very happy to accept those allocations.
Mm-hmm.
But then we can put them in a situation where they're getting less than their partner. So let's say they're getting one candy and their partner's getting four. So this is an interesting dilemma because now, presumably the actor wants that one Skittle, but, they don't really want the partner to get more than them. So they have to decide, am I okay accepting one thing and letting my partner have more than me? Or would I rather we both get nothing?
Mm.
And what we find is that even children at the bottom end of our age range, so four-year-olds, will reject those allocations.
Really?
Yeah, that means effectively they're paying the price of one Skittle to prevent their partner from getting more than them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what you might have seen in our papers as that's labeled disadvantageous inequity aversion. So it's an aversion to payoffs where I'm getting less than someone else. And then we can also, in using this exact same game, look at the reverse form of allocation. So one where the actor gets four candies and their partner gets one. So mm-hmm. now, they get this amazing payoff, their partner's getting less, and now they face a sort of different dilemma, which is, I really want these four candies, but maybe I know it's unfair to my partner, so should I accept them and let them get less than me, or should I reject it and make us both get nothing?
Mm-hmm.
And there, what you might expect having interacted with children is that young children are totally fine with those allocations.
Do they ever take the four Skittles and then away from the game, give one to the other kid?
So that kind of behavior actually doesn't happen spontaneously, but part of that might be that these children don't know one another.
Yeah.
Those things that would happen more organically in a relationship that's established just don't happen that much in this. And we also try to discourage talking and things like that to the best of our ability. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing about this form of reaction is that children by about 8 or 9, at least in America or the US populations that we've studied, tend to reject those. So here is a case where they're sacrificing 4 candies to prevent a partner from getting less than them, which is really costly adherence to a norm of equality.
Yeah, for sure. So you alluded to a question that I had in my mind about, you know, you do these experiments and you find children that don't know each other and get them to divide candies across them. But most of the time, if I have to share something, it's probably with somebody that I know. You know, it's not like I get one shot to take candy from you and then I never have to see you again. So how do we mesh the economic models that talk about how I'm supposed to try and get as much as I can for myself, or the fairness models that say an equal split is the best thing, with the idea that, you know, I have to see you again tomorrow. Well, I don't have to see you again tomorrow, but I have to see my daughter again tomorrow. And if I give her the short end of the stick, then she might end up remembering that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And in several kinds of games, including like these more straightforward giving tasks where you have a set of resources and you can share with a strange kid you don't know or with someone who's a friend, kids will give more to the friend, of course. In our particular, the inequity game type design, when we started out, we wanted to try to rule out this possibility that kids were coming in to the game with a history and might have future interactions with this partner. That allowed us to focus just on the cognitive mechanism here, which is how are you responding to the inequality. Mm-hmm. But in follow-up studies, we did a large cross-cultural study testing in 7 different societies, including the U.S. And when we did this again in the U.S., we tested about 200 pairs of kids, and half of them were friends and the other half were not. And we saw no differences there.
Really?
In this task. Yes. It was surprising to us too. Uh-huh. We really thought we would see differences.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that it can't explain some of the variation that we saw in some of the other societies. So for example, in Mexico, we tested a group of indigenous peoples there called the Maya in the Yucatan Peninsula. And in those villages, the villages are very small and all the kids know each other. So there was no way to get kids who didn't know each other to play the game. Mm-hmm. And in this particular place, we saw that kids were much more likely to accept having a disadvantage. So it took them until about 9 years of age, much later than we see in the U.S., and at much lower levels. So kids in Mexico are rejecting this bad deal offer much less often than in the U.S. And that could be explained by the relationship between the kids in that particular community as compared to some of the other places we were at.
Mm-hmm. Are you referring to the study that you did that you published in Nature? Is that the big one? Yeah, because you looked at a bunch of different cultures, didn't you? Were there other findings that were really interesting coming from some of the other cultures that you looked at?
Yeah, Katie.
Yeah, so one finding.
We'll say where.
Yeah, so we tested children in 7 different countries. So we tested children in the USA and Canada, and then those are 2 Western cultures, and then this group in Mexico that Peter mentioned, and then India, Peru, Uganda, and Senegal. Mm. And I can kind of summarize the 2 main findings, or the one main finding, which is that we saw disadvantageous inequity aversion. So this thing that I described earlier, where children are willing to pay the price of 1 Skittle to prevent their partner from getting 4. We saw that everywhere. Mm. And as Peter already mentioned, we didn't see it at exactly the same time and at exactly the same rate everywhere. But the main finding there is that there was fairly low cross-cultural variation and that it seemed to be everywhere. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of a candidate for something that we might consider to be a universal human behavior. And our claim is that this is probably a very foundational response, this response to getting less than someone else. We see it in young kids, and we see it in all the places that we've tested so far. But that other form of response to unfairness, this advantageous inequity aversion, where you have to give up a lot to prevent someone from getting less than you, that we only saw in three places. So the USA, which we expected based on our previous findings, Canada, which is not so dissimilar from the USA in many respects, and I say that as a Canadian.
In some respects, yes. In others, as an English person.
And then the sort of surprising finding to us was that we also saw advantageous inequity aversion in Uganda. And so there are many explanations for that, but the two kind of primary ones are, well, the one thing is it could be that sort of norms of equality are really emphasized there as they are in the States. And so that's why children in, as they enter late childhood are starting to incur this cost to enforce fairness. So it's possible that it's sort of just convergence of this behavior that we're seeing across these societies. But another possibility, which is, I think we have to consider quite seriously, is that this place where we were testing in Uganda is influenced by Western teachers. So they come and they, it's at a school where Westerners will come and help with curriculum development. And at the time that we were running this was apparently a time that had been preceded by a lot of conflict in between schools. So they're very competitive in debating and spelling bees. And so apparently in response to some of this like extreme competition, teachers had been really emphasizing norms of fairness and emphasizing kindness and generosity. And in fact, I just went back last summer to the same school to do testing for another study. And I noticed all of these posters around that are exactly the types of posters that you'd see in a primary school here, which say like fairness, you know, treat everyone equally, kindness, think of others before yourself. So it's possible that what we were seeing was really sort of the Western norm that had been introduced in some respects by these West teachers.
Fascinating. So it seems as though this is very much linked to the idea of sharing and how you go about socializing that process. And I come from a parenting philosophy that says that you know, sharing will come with time as the child understands it in their own mind, and that, you know, telling the child to share something doesn't necessarily help a very young child, younger than in your study, because they don't have the cognitive ability to understand that properly yet. Does that have basis in science?
I mean, I think what Peter mentioned earlier sort of aligns with that, that even if they do understand it, they might just ignore it. So they might say like, I know that you're telling me to be fair. I know that I should be fair, but I'm not going to be fair. So what I think it is really interesting to both of us right now is understanding the processes that lead to an alignment between knowing what I should be doing and knowing and actually doing what I should be doing.
Yeah. So how does that process happen? How do the kids resolve those conflicts where they know they're supposed to be fair, but they just don't want to yet? And how does that progress into, I know I'm supposed to be fair and I'm going to be fair?
So I have a line of research that where we started to investigate this question, and we were particularly interested in how parents might influence children's sharing and generosity behavior. So we tested in the U.S. again, and then we went to the same rural villages in India that we had tested for the other seven cultures project. We've gone back there several times now. And we asked the parents to demonstrate a generous donation. So we asked the parents secretly so that the kids didn't know this, and the parents were asked either to give 9 out of 10 items to another person or just give 1 out of 10. So we had a generous and a stingy condition. And we had kids also do a control condition where we just saw what they did on their own without seeing the parent do anything. And the question was whether kids would spontaneously imitate the parents. And what we found was a real striking difference between the two cultures. So in the US, kids would give a bit more after they saw the parent be generous. So the parents giving 90% away, kids would not give anywhere near that. They would give up to about 50%. And then they would, it's as if they were saying, yeah, I think that's enough. But it seemed like they were using the norm of equality as in a strategic way. And then in India, what we found is that the kids were far more likely to be generous, almost as generous as the parents. And a big chunk of the kids gave 90% away as well after seeing the parent. So this was a first study, and we're trying to go back to do some more tests. But our working hypothesis right now is that this could have to do with the different values that are emphasized in these two places. So in the U.S., parents are encouraging their kids to be independent and think for themselves. And one consequence of that might be that the kids are actually doing that when it comes
to darn it.
Behavior. So if you want your child to follow your lead and being generous, it could backfire, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. They're learning something else, right? They're learning how to be independent. And then in India, we believe that based on some anthropological work there, that the values of obeying elders are emphasized to a larger degree. Mm. So we need to test this, but that's our working hypothesis right now.
Okay.
I have data that are related to that because we also did a sharing game this time in the US where we gave children explicit norms about what they should be doing. So we said, and we gave them either a selfish norm or a generous norm, very similar to what Peter described. And we also saw this effect that the older children, when they were told to give 8 out of 10, were sort of bound by equality. You couldn't push them past equality. But then we also found that they were not as susceptible to the selfish norm as the younger children. So if we said give 2, the 8-year-olds wouldn't really give 2. It's like they kind of knew that that was too wrong. Whereas the 4 and 5 were like, oh, sweet, I can give 2? Amazing. And they tended to, it sort of seemed like they were using that as a licensing, sort of like a licensing effect where they were like, well, I know I shouldn't give 2, but if you tell me it's okay to give 2, I'm going to give 2.
Hmm. Okay. Shifting gears a little bit, we've talked a little bit about the development of racism on the podcast and how that that whole thing happens. And you know, I had always assumed that if you just don't talk about race to your child, that your child won't be racist. And then I did the research and found out that I was totally wrong. So if any listeners missed that episode, you might want to go out and check that out because there's a lot of interesting stuff in there. But I know that Katie, you did some research on how children perceive fairness related to in groups and out groups. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because that's really a very active line of my lab at the moment. If I can just ask a quick question, did you interview anyone for that podcast?
I did not. No, if you have suggestions, I would.
I mean, one person who's a good friend of both of us, or both of ours rather, is Yarrow Dunham at Yale.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Does a lot of work on the development of both implicit and explicit attitudes about race and about other types of social categories. So he'd be a good one. And actually the work that most of the work that I've done on the intergroup work is with Yarrow as well. Yeah. So one thing to say about the general approach to studying this question, well, at least how I've done it with children, is not to look at real social categories like gender or race or age, but rather to assign children to minimal groups. So this means that they come into the lab and we tell them either you're on the blue team or you're on the yellow team. Mm-hmm. And this really induces in-group bias in children. Like suddenly, you know, even if they know they're randomly assigned to a group, suddenly they really care about the fact that they're on this blue team, which is nice because you can then study the effects of in-group favoritism without the sort of baggage that comes with known social categories. Mm-hmm. So it's a really nice method for doing that. And I've used that method across a couple of different games. The one that you might have read is the third-party punishment game. So this is one where the child comes in and is learning about someone who has been unfair to someone else. And then they are given an opportunity to punish them for their unfair behavior or to kind of stand by and let it happen. And what we found in this study, and this was spearheaded by Jillian Jordan, who was a thesis student at Harvard at the time. What she did, she found was that children tend to be especially forgiving of in-group members who have been unfair, which means they're especially punitive of out-group members who have been unfair. So if you're an out-group member and you've been selfish, say you've kept all sweets for yourself, you haven't shared any, I'm very likely to punish you for that. But if you're in my in-group and you've done exactly the same thing, I'm a little less likely to punish you for that. Hmm. Which suggests that children's sort of tendency to intervene in this kind of context is pulled by this competing motive of in-group favoritism. Mm-hmm. So I've then done 2 studies, one in collaboration with Peter, looking at children in 2 different contexts. So one in the ultimatum game, which is where someone has been directly unfair to the target. So here, a child learned that someone has offered them a really unfair split of resources. And they learned that this person was either in their in-group or in their out-group. And the question is, will they be really annoyed if the out-group member offered them unfairness, but maybe more forgiving if an in-group member was unfair, or potentially the opposite? And what we found there, and this is a paper actually that will be coming out soon in a journal called Journal of Experimental Psychology General, there we found that sort of fairness trumps group bias. So when you're in a situation where you're directly involved in the unfair interaction and you've just been treated unfairly, you know, that's what really motivates you to respond. It's not, and that sort of overrides any existing group bias that you might feel. And then we found a similar thing in the inequity game. So what I'm starting to see in the work that I've done on this is that there's a big difference between stepping back and watching unfairness happen between others mm-hmm. versus being directly involved in the unfairness interaction yourself. And it seems like when you're in that position where you're watching and you're removed from the situation, that's where in-group bias matters. But when you're right in the thick of it, in-group bias doesn't matter as much.
Yeah, that, I'm actually thinking of a viral video that's going around at the moment of a woman. I don't remember where she was, but she's in a store and there are two Hispanic ladies and it looks like one of them cut in front of her in line and she just lets go with this tirade and all the people in the line behind her just don't say anything.
Oh, wow.
And I'm wondering if there's something there, you know, if the because the two women at the front are both Hispanic and they're a different race than all the other people in the group, you know, is it because of the thing that you mentioned where, you know, it's a bit, well, they're not my group and I'm not going to say anything. is that the same idea?
Yeah. So most theories, sort of higher level theories about why we'd see this interface between group bias and cooperation are exactly that. Mm-hmm. These norms should apply to your group and should not necessarily transfer across group boundaries. So norms ought to be enforced particularly strongly within the group. What's interesting, and that theory really makes sense for the reasons that I think are sort of intuitive. What's interesting is that when you look at the data from adults and children, we actually don't see that so much. Like our third-party punishment study is one nice example where you actually see, you know, more punishment of out-group members than of in-group members. So in kind of going back to your analogy there, you would have expected someone in the that was in the out-group in the line to intervene and punish these other two women. So I think like the intuition is that it should be in one direction, but at the moment the data aren't really lining up with that.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, you know, what can parents do, if anything, to you know, maybe not override is the right word, but, you know, to sort of maybe blur those boundaries between in-groups and out-groups a little bit? Is that a valid thing to even try and do?
Well, Katie has an advantage here because she has a child.
And do you do experiments on your own child?
True.
Both of those things. I think, well, first of all, I should say that there are lots of people who could answer this question in a much more educated way than I could or than either of us could. I think that there's some data to suggest that with real social categories, exposure helps, but I'm not sure the extent to which that those data are really persuasive. I mean, just directly inferring from what I've just told you about in terms of how group bias can be eroded in terms of fairness interactions, one conclusion could be that if you encourage children to really take the perspectives of others and put themselves in the shoes of those who are being treated unfairly, then maybe sort of fairness would trump in group bias in even in this situation where they're divorced from what's actually happening.
Yeah.
But that's as far as I'm willing to go with that.
I'll put out another strategy, which I don't know. I'm looking at Katie to see if she can back this up, but I've heard Yarrow talk about this. That you could, another strategy could be to point out the groups that you're both a member of. So you go back to those people in the line and you could say, hey, we're all Red Sox fans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, oh, we're all women.
there's always some other group you can appeal to, you know. Mm-hmm. So there's multiple ways to mark the group. But I don't know how that works with kids.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thanks for going out on a limb on that. So one thing that I did want to probe on a little bit is that, you know, so many of your studies are experimental in nature, which in some ways is awesome because you really get to understand a bit more about cause and effect than you do in other types of studies. But I'm sure you're familiar with the late Professor Yuri Bronfenbrenner's criticism about developmental psychology, and I'm going to quote, it's being the science of strange behavior of children in strange situations with strange adults for the briefest possible periods of time. And I'm wondering if you can help us to understand how we can know that these kinds of experiments that you're doing have what Dr. Bronfenbrenner would call ecological validity. You know, do they test what we think they're testing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Yuri Bronfenbrenner was very influential that's just one critique that he had of experimental studies, but he wasn't rejecting experiments as an approach. Just to bring it up to a broader context, his bigger picture was that development occurs within a social context, and there are multiple levels of those contexts. Mm-hmm. And I think the cross-cultural work that we're doing and that other people have been working on is trying to get at those different levels to see, like, well, where is the variation in children's behavior? Mm-hmm. In answering one of his other criticisms, we're trying to get beyond testing kids who are just U.S. citizens, mm-hmm. and then generalizing from there. So yeah. I think his main critique was that we're overgeneralizing a lot from experiments.
Yeah.
But to get to the point about ecological validity, one response to that is that our experiments have face validity. Face validity means that if you want to study the behavior, you actually create the context where the behavior occurs. So we give children candy and put them in a situation where they can share. So anything I give to you is costly to me. That is, at face value, altruism. That's by definition. So it is a costly and meaningful action. And once we have those experimental paradigms set up, then we can vary aspects of the context to figure out precisely, we can try to describe the cognitive processes that are at work there. So that's one kind of answer. But when ecological validity comes up, I also like to point out that, you know, this exists on a wide spectrum. And it goes all the way from an fMRI machine, which has zero ecological validity, mm-hmm. to anthropological observations. And we don't want to reject any evidence out of hand. And even though laying in an fMRI machine is about as far away from the real world interactions as you can get.
And just so we're clear, what you're talking about is putting someone in a machine that scans their brain while you ask them to do a certain task, right?
Exactly. Yep. Yet we've learned a tremendous amount about neuro. Don't think you'll find anyone who says we shouldn't take neuroscience seriously. Mm-hmm. So often people say, well, this isn't ecologically valid. You could respond to that by saying, well, do you reject neuroscience?
Is that your standard comeback?
Depends who I'm talking to.
Okay. Yeah. Point taken.
I think that there's something else here that we would love to do. I mean, any experimentalist would love to have a sense of how these behaviors translate into real world interactions. And in particular, I mean, one thing that would be fascinating is to follow the children that, you know, do our experiment at age 4 all the way through adolescence and adulthood, and if we have any early predictors of social behavior later on. And at the moment, you know, as this quotation said, people, you know, these children, we see them for 10 minutes and then never again.
Yeah.
That's certainly true of the park. Now, lab studies are in a slightly better position in this regard because the same families do come to the lab regularly. So there is some hope there. But yeah, I mean, I think doing any sort of longitudinal work in for these sorts of questions would be really good.
Mm. Yeah, the problem is it's very expensive.
Yeah. Yeah.
And ideally, you know, we would see that happen in multiple cultures.
Yeah.
So that's kind of our orientation these days.
Yeah.
Can we take this abroad?
Yeah. Well, there's your next project.
It's a couple of million dollars.
Excellent. I'll get right on that. So we usually wrap up our episodes by just thinking about what, if anything, parents can and even should do to help their children in the area that we're talking about. And we've touched on this several times as we've moved through. And I'm wondering if if this is, I mean, obviously parents are already influencing the ways their children think about fairness. Should they be doing it differently than maybe the common intuition is for how to teach fairness? Or, you know, should we be trying to instill more of a collectivist model in our children to encourage cooperation with others? You know, what's your general sense of what parents can and should do to instill a sense of fairness in their children?
I mean, yeah, this is a really interesting question. And I think I agree broadly with something you said earlier, which is they probably don't have to do a whole lot and mm-hmm. still fairness is going to come online in some regards. Mm-hmm. But I think it's true, certainly with things like advantageous inequity aversion, which we've talked about a bit, that shows quite a bit of flexibility across cultures and even within cultures across different contexts. I think, you know, like helping children overcome those sorts of costs and understand that they need to be fair to someone else, I think their parents can influence them. And one thing Peter made a note, and I'm going to steal this point because I think it's a good one, and I actually have some new data to suggest that this is true. Perspective taking, really encouraging children to perspective take and thinking about what it's like to be at the receiving end of an unfair deal. So, mm-hmm. you know, maybe mm-hmm. you've got four candies, but this means your partner has one candy. You know, how is that going to make them feel? That might be able to help in some respects. Mm. Another thing I think, and I have some data, we have a project on this, is really like reputational cues are important to children. And so making them aware that they're being watched. Now, this is not something that you want to do in a sort of awkward way, but I think we have data from lots of studies, not our own, but other work as well, showing that children tend to sort of cheat less and be more generous and be more, or not more generous, but at least more fair when their behaviors are going to be visible to others. So I think emphasizing the reputational benefits of being a fair person might also help.
Mm-hmm. So not necessarily mom is watching you and you better be fair, but you know, the other kids around you are noticing what you're doing and they might not want to play with you tomorrow if you take all the toys.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. And in terms of perspective taking, I'm just curious as to what age you can start to encourage that, do you think?
So in our particular tasks, I mean, we've seen some effect of this, we think. We haven't tested it explicitly, but around 6 years of age. So remember that we in the U.S., we typically find that kids will reject getting more and getting less by around eight. Mm-hmm. But when we did this new variation of the task where kids had to look at things from the other person's side, we found that younger kids, about age six, would also start to reject both forms of inequality. Mm-hmm. That gave us a kind of hint that like, oh, maybe it's this, you know, they're actually forcing them to take the perspective of the other person is helping them see what it's like from their side. So that's one possibility. We know that kids can do perspective taking much younger than that. So it's a question of why it only starts to link up and matter with fairness at a later age. And mm-hmm. I'm sure other people will find it younger.
Yeah. I'm thinking about theory of mind research, and that tends to come up around age four, I think, doesn't it? Where you can start to understand that other people have a point of view different from you.
And in even that, you can find evidence that children understand other people's perspectives and beliefs at a younger age. So depending on the experimental design. So I think we have a long way to go to find out more. But I wouldn't say that four is not too young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
I could add one more thing in terms of, based on some other work that not by Katie and myself, but by some other people, showing that when children are put in more of a condition where they are in control of the resources and get to decide how to allocate them, they can be more generous in some cases. We believe that this is activating more of a, this is more about an altruistic motivation as opposed to fairness. But it is that there's an interesting pattern of findings across several studies that show this. So one that's been done by a woman who's a postdoc working with me right now, her name is Nadia Cherniak. She found that when she kind of strongly encouraged kids to give one sticker away to a doll that was sad, then subsequently gave them a chance to give to someone else, they were more generous in the second step, giving more to the other partner in that case than they kept for themselves. So this seems to contradict what we've found in our fairness studies. But as I said, my own view is that this is actually a distinct psychological process. It's more about altruism than about fairness.
Okay.
And Nadia probably disagrees, but
graduate students. So I know we're almost out of time here, but because you mentioned it, I wonder if you could just distinguish between altruism and fairness, and you know why there are different mechanisms going on there.
Yeah. So should I take this one?
Sure.
So this has been an ongoing discussion, and people do disagree with us mm-hmm. on this. But in our new paper, that's a theory paper that's coming out, we try to describe this in more detail. But in the main point is that in our inequity game, if children are rejecting candy, where they're giving up a piece for themselves in order to prevent the peer from getting more than them, they're going against their self-interest, but they're also not being nice. Mm-hmm. They're denying candy to the other kid. So this seems to capture something that's very distinct. It's very much not an altruistic act to reject those offers, but it is fair. So using this particular design and testing it in various ways, we've made this argument that there seem to be different psychological processes that are at work, and we can push them around at different ages and in different ways, which provides more evidence that it's a different psychology that you're slipping into.
Mm-hmm. And just one other piece of evidence that I think lines up with the fact that altruism and fairness are probably dissociable is that we see evidence for, this is going to take us off on a little tangent, but I'm going to, we do see some evidence for altruism in animals where mm-hmm. they'll sort of incur a cost to confer a benefit to another individual. But we see very weak evidence for fairness.
Interesting.
Compared to what we see in children.
Yeah, you've done a lot of animal work as well, haven't you?
Yeah. Right, yeah. So I think that's nice evidence as well.
Yeah. So I'm just curious, what do the people who disagree with you think? They think it's the same mechanism at work?
Yes, there is a debate about whether there's two separate mechanisms or whether there's one overarching mechanism. Mm-hmm. One position that's come out recently is that these really are capturing the same thing, and it's really about minimizing inequality between groups. So when I give some of my pile of resources to you, I'm making it less equal. And in a similar way, when I reject the offers in our inequity game, I'm making things closer to equality. So that's possible. I think experimentally we can show that they're distinct, but we're at the point of these positions are just being formulated mm-hmm. now. So okay. we'll
be
fighting
edge.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for giving us a preview of that. And thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank
fun.
You.
So as a reminder to listeners, all the references for today's episode can be found on yourparentingmojo.com/fairness. And I also wanted to let you know that hot off the press, Peter and Katie have a new article coming out. Can we get a link to that article?
I can send it when it comes out.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. It's going to be called The Developmental Foundations of Fairness, and it's going to be published in Nature and Human Behavior, which is quite an accomplishment. So congratulations on that, and thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift. 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.